For 6 consecutive days, heavy rain had battered the hills surrounding Holmfirth, sending hundreds of tons of water streaming through the narrow gorges and several valleys down into the lowlands where it would be collected. Normally, plenty of rainfall wouldn't be a problem, and in fact it would benefit the many large mills and cottages that were dotted alongside the hillside, whose businesses were reliant on fast flowing water. And in the summertime, the true benefits of having such large amounts of water would become apparent, as when any prolonged dry spells occurred, it would often render many operational businesses redundant due to the lack of rain. To solve such issues, a group of businessmen and mill owners formed the Holmfirth Reservoir Commissioners, which would ultimately construct a series of reservoirs, one being the Bilbrick Reservoir that was situated around 3.5 miles above Holmfirth. Built sometime in 1840 and immense in size, Bilbrick Reservoir was between 500 and 600 yards long, roughly 120 yards broad and from 50 to 60 foot deep. It covered several acres of land, as one can imagine, and it could hold several thousands of cubic feet of water with the embankment withstanding immense pressure. During preparatory work, a small spring was uncovered, and rather than a culvert being built to divert the water safely away, a decision was made to simply plug the spring using nothing but clay and rubble, with the assumption that the weight of the embankment above it would be sufficient enough to divert the flow of water elsewhere. But unfortunately, during the early hours of Thursday, October 5th, 1852, the embankment, after withstanding days of severe rainfall, suddenly breached, sending an estimated 86 million gallons of water thundering down the Holme Valley, along the River Holme and towards the small picturesque town of Holmfirth, and the decision to plug the discovered spring would prove to be a fateful one. The days leading up to February the 5th had seen the water level in the Bilbury Reservoir continue to rise, and efforts to open the shuttle valves in the lowest sections of the waste pipe began in earnest. Now, it was hoped that by opening these valves, excess water would be allowed to drain through a tunnel under the reservoir and thus relieve the pressure from above. On Wednesday the 4th of February, the Swallow, or safety pit, where the excess flowed into could no longer hold any more water, and by 10 p.m. that evening, water had begun to flow over the embankment, joining the rivulets and streams further down below the valley. Some employees of the water board would make regular visits to the embankment, monitoring what was happening, and it would soon become apparent that the stability of the retaining wall was becoming weakened to an extent that something serious may occur. And within an hour, at around 1 o'clock in the morning on Thursday the 5th of February, the embankment finally gave way, allowing the accumulated waters from the reservoir to surge down and into the valley. The rain had finally ceased and the moon was shining in the night sky, but the irreversible nature of the incident would quickly bring about total destruction of many of the mills and cottages that were in the water's pathway. The River Holme, which was normally a relatively slow-moving river, would quickly swell, and the torrent of water thundering its way along would easily sweep away many of the obstacles in front of it. Holmfirth had a population of around 6,000, most of whom were in bed when the embankment burst, and the only warnings were given by a few watchers or employees who had begun to run down into the town as soon as they realised what was about to happen. Shouting and screaming, some even threw stones towards bedroom windows to startle people from their sleep. But despite their best endeavours, it appears only those living closest to the reservoir would hear these warnings, whereas those further in the town wouldn't have the opportunity to flee their homes in time. The floodwaters soon passed the beginning of Holmfirth, overtaking the watchers and taking them with it towards their own impending death. The rain began to fall again, and the scenes just minutes after the water had rushed into the town cannot be described in all its fullness. For example, the streets would soon be crowded with people, some still in their nightwear, who were rushing around in a state of frenzy, seeking their family members and friends, with some already mourning the loss of loved ones. Mills that had once stood proud as a monument to the hard-working people of the town now lay in ruins. Bilbury Mill, which had stood a few hundred yards below the reservoir, was completely destroyed, losing around 10 feet as well as its gable end. Digley Upper Mill was partially washed away, together with all of the farm buildings that at the time had contained 12 tons of hay and plenty of livestock. Seven cottages nearby were swept away with the torrent, but fortunately the inmates of these cottages had somehow escaped with their lives. Back End Mill and all its machinery was almost wholly destroyed, and Holmbridge Church had lost its surrounding wall. The graveyard had become an almost unsightly spectacle, and the interior of the church was destroyed, with floodwaters rising to almost 5 feet. The floor, covered in several inches of sand and mud, was torn up and pews were seen floating. In the centre of the aisle was laid the body of a goat which had been swept away from Upper Digley Mill. But more shockingly, the body of an infant was found resting on the seat of one of the pews, and on top of the stairs leading into the gallery lay the coffin and remains of a fully grown man. These were not the only bodies to be discovered, as several others had been washed up from their graves by the whirlpools formed by the headlong current of water as it passed by the graveyard. Further along, the devastation became much worse, and with a considerable loss of life. 6 houses along Water Street were completely destroyed, killing nearly all of those present within them. One house within this neighbourhood, whilst not destroyed by the onrushing water, was completely flooded in the basement, which had contained 16 individuals. Miraculously, they all survived by escaping and making their way onto an adjoining roof. But others were not so lucky. James Booth and his wife, along with a lodger, all drowned, as did Joseph Brooke, his wife and their young child. Sadly, his wife would later be found still clutching her infant in her arms. A nearby Wesleyan chapel, just like Holmbridge Church before it, was badly hit, losing part of the vestry and its interior being badly damaged. It was reported that it only took around 15 minutes from the initial breach of the embankment to the floodwaters entering Holmfirth and causing so much death and destruction, and something that had never been seen on such a large scale. Heart-wrenching scenes of people trying their hardest to rescue drowning people who were being tossed around in the strong currents soon became a common sight, with men and women reaching out trying to grab hold of those poor souls being taken away in an instant. The devastation seemed to be never-ending, with stories of heroism and of course tragedy all soon becoming apparent, and the hours after the initial destruction many people would be seen searching for the bodies of the victims. The areas damaged from the collapse of the Bilberry Reservoir would stretch over several miles, and whilst the effects of the power of the torrent would diminish the further it went, it could be easily traced over acres and acres of land. Bilberry Mill, as we have already mentioned, was the first to fall, followed by extensive damage to Middle Digley Mill and Lower Digley Mill. Luckily for both owners and the families of these mills, they had been alerted in time and had managed to escape from the torrents that would eventually take their livelihoods. But upwards of 100 people would ultimately be thrown out of their employment due to the destruction of both properties. Other mills such as Bottom Mills, Victoria Woolen Mills, Dyson's Woolen Mill, Farrow's Upper Mill and Farrow's Lower Mill would also suffer varying degrees of destruction. Some so badly damaged that broken machinery and furniture had barricaded the mills from the outside world. Many streets had become impassable due to the mud, wreckage and larger pieces of timber and trees that had accumulated, and despite many volunteers offering their services to search for victims as well as begin the process of removing wreckage from the river, heavy rain during Saturday and Sunday would eventually prevent them from carrying on. But despite the many drawbacks, by early morning on Sunday 8th of February around 65 bodies had been recovered and placed in public houses in and around Holmfirth. Most had been identified except for 3. And as with any event of this magnitude, there seemed to be an influx of strangers into the town who had arrived simply to gratify their own morbid curiosity by inspecting the roots of the devastation. But this also brought more problems to the area, as it appears that light-fingered men had arrived from various nearby districts to take advantage of the tragedy, pilfering what they could. In one example, 5 men were apprehended in Holmfirth and handcuffed before being sent to Huddersfield on the last train, where they would then be transported to the local police station. The funerals of the victims commenced on Saturday, 7th of February, with 25-year-old Betsy Earnshaw being one of the first people to be buried. 5 more people were also interred, with the youngest being just 1 year old, that of Sarah Hannah Dodd. On Sunday, 8th of February, many more victims will be interred, with services taking place in several locations within Holmfirth itself. Nine people were buried within the grounds of the Hinchcliffe Mill Wesleyan Methodist Chapel, just off Woodhead Road. A further 12 victims were also interred at St John's in Upper Thong. Holmfirth Wesleyan Chapel, Christchurch, St Mary's and All Hallows will complete the list of places where several services took place later that same day. Over the course of the week, many more burials would take place, but it would be 4 months later, in June, when the final victim would be interred, that of 58-year-old James Metrick, whose body was interred at Hinchcliffe Mill Wesleyan Methodist Chapel. Now, it would take the people of Holmfirth many days, weeks and months to come to the terms of the devastation heaped on them, but more was to come, as in many parts of the town, typhus began to reign paramount. Homes with their damp walls had become breeding grounds for mould, and outside, rotting animal corpses that still lined the streets as well as the riverbed had begun to give off a strong stench of death, helped by the rays of the sun, which in turn brought in a huge influx of rats to the area. To compound the misery, an outbreak of smallpox in nearby Neverthong was the last thing the people of Holmfirth needed. The inquest into the tragedy took place within the railway tavern on the 6th of February, and over the course of a month, a further five more would take place, finally ending on the 27th of February 1852. It would be a long, drawn-out inquest, with many witnesses being interviewed and cross-examined, and it appears that blame would be apportioned to many people, and yet, not a single person would admit any responsibility. No one admitted having overall responsibility either for the building of the dam or for its day-to-day management. Witnesses came forward saying how weak the embankments had become in the months prior to the disaster, and that concerns had been raised with the engineer of the dam as well as the commissioners, but very little, if anything, had been done to avert these concerns. In the end, and after a lengthy and detailed statement given by Richard Clement Moody, also known as Captain Moody, he would go on to say, "The execution of the work was not what it ought to have been, and bad execution in works of this kind, or any work connected with water, is fatal. The works must be good and watertight, or they will become dangerous and their destruction must come sooner or later." The jury retired for around 2 hours, and on their return the foreman delivered their verdict, which said, "We find that Eliza Marsden came to her death by drowning, caused by the bursting of the Bilberry Reservoir. We also find that the Bilberry Reservoir was defective in its original construction, and that the commissioners, engineers and overlookers were greatly culpable in not seeing to the proper regulations of the works. And we also find that the commissioners, in permitting the Bilberry Reservoir to remain in a dangerous state with a full knowledge thereof, and not lowering the waste pit, have been guilty of great and culpable negligence. And we regret that the reservoir being under the management of a corporation prevents us from bringing in a verdict of manslaughter, as we are convinced that the gross and culpable negligence of the commissioners would have subjected them to such a verdict had they been in the position of private citizens. We also hope that the legislature will take into the most serious consideration the propriety of making provision for Her Majesty's subjects, exposed to danger from reservoirs placed by corporations in situations similar to those under the charge of the Holmes Reservoir Commissioners." During the inquest, several subscriptions and donations were set up by volunteers to solicit money to aid those affected by the tragedy. People were more than willing to help, and as word soon spread, donations from all over the country were soon being received. On Saturday, 7th of February, a committee was appointed to look after the donations, and around £1,000 was soon collected. Donations from Huddersfield, Bradford, Halifax, Dewsbury and Leeds soon followed, along with more money from London, and not before too long, a final sum of over £67,000 had been collected. Now, this money would go towards not only helping those that had lost pretty much everything, but it would also help with the rebuilding of Bilberry Dam, which amounted to around £7,000. The disaster that took place during the early hours of the 5th of February 1852 saw a total of 4 mills completely destroyed, with a further 17 more seriously damaged. 10 dye houses had been destroyed, with another 5 also badly damaged. 27 cottages, 6 bridges, 10 warehouses, 7 shops and 8 barns and stables had also been lost in the flood, with a further 129 cottages being seriously or badly damaged. and whilst the recorded total number of deaths has been placed at 81, it does seem a plausible guess that this number may in fact be well short of the final figure, as some people would die, as already mentioned, from the after effects of the flood due to typhus that soon spread within the Burnley and Hinchcliffe Mill areas. I do hope you enjoyed this story, although it is a tragic event that took the lives of so many people. If you have listened to it from our website at www.daysofhorror.com, please comment in the comment box down below. But in the meantime, as I always say guys, take care, look after yourselves, and I'll be back soon with another tale from our glorious, if not dark, past.